Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson, and in this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to my friend and fellow freelancer turned blogger plus much, much more, Paul Jarvis. I've long admired Paul's blog because of his incredibly down-to-earth, relatable, and conversational style of writing that makes you feel right at home when you're reading his material. But now I'm getting a little ahead of myself. Paul got his start as a freelance web designer back in the 1990s. He eventually worked his way up to landing paid gigs working with companies like Mercedes-Benz, Microsoft, Warner Music, and massive business influencers like Marie Forleo and Danielle Laporte. Since then, Paul's built an audience of hundreds of thousands of readers for his blog. He's helped over 10,000 paying students through his courses like Creative Class, which teaches the business side of freelancing, and Chimp Essentials, which shows you how to leverage MailChimp for your business. Paul's launched countless side projects too, ranging from website analytics tools to writing platforms, WordPress plugins, and more. On top of all of this, though, Paul is now the author of his first published book, Company of One: Why Staying Small is the Next Big Thing for Business. And what's so awesome about this book is that it's not about growing your business. It's about how companies and even solopreneurs can be better without having to grow bigger. This is a philosophy that you can see at work in Paul's own life, where he actively chooses to only build the size of business that he can personally manage himself, where he still gets to personally practice his craft rather than growing it far beyond his own power in a way that forces him to become merely a manager of his business. Paul's book is eye-opening, it's insightful, and most of all, it's refreshing, so please check it out. And it officially comes out in January of 2019, but if you pre-order it from Paul today, you'll get a ton of cool bonuses. You can check it all out at ofone.co. But for now, back to our interview with Paul. In this episode, Paul and I talk about how he navigated the transition from starting out as a freelancer to eventually running a diversified business with his own digital products, SaaS tools, blog, books, and other sources of income. We dig into Paul's personal writing practices, habits, routines, and how he's honed his voice as a writer over the years, including how he eventually went from blogging to compiling his book, Company of One. We cover how he grew his personal brand by landing columns on publications like Fast Company, Bloomberg, Inc. Magazine, the biggest mistakes he's made as an entrepreneur, his best advice for aspiring bloggers, and seriously, so much more. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with Paul Jarvis. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, man.
It's great to reconnect again and to give everyone here watching, listening, some more background on Paul. He's basically who I aspire to become within my own business. Paul got his start as a freelance designer. He's since grown his blog up to 30,000 email subscribers, launched online courses with more than 10,000 paying students on topics ranging from freelancing to email marketing. He's the author of his upcoming book, Company of One, coming out in January of 2019. He's contributed to sites like Fast Company, Bloomberg, Inc. Magazine. He's launched multiple software as a service businesses. Did I miss anything there?
I do a couple podcasts too. It's way too many things though.
A man of many talents. I like it. So, Paul, you got your start with freelancing back in the 90s. So who are some of the companies you've gotten to work with, you know, just over the years? What's the highlight list?
Yeah, I mean, I started working with pro athletes, which is a funny way to start, but that's where I started, was doing websites for players in the NFL, NBA, NHL, probably a couple baseball players. I don't really care about baseball, sorry. So I don't remember any of them, but people like Steve Nash, Warren Sapp, Shaquille O'Neal back in the day, they were big names. I guess Steve Nash kind of still is. Does he have gyms in the US? He has gyms in Canada.
That's actually a great question. I have no idea.
I have no idea either. So yeah, I worked with, total aside, but yeah. I did websites for people like Microsoft, Mercedes-Benz, Warner Music, and then entrepreneurs like Marie Forleo, Danielle Laporte, Chris Carr. It's kind of spanned the gamut of clients. So I would pick a niche, focus on that, and then be like, oh, maybe I'll try a different niche and then move on to that and focus on that. So yeah.
I love that. Do you have any particular projects or clients that stick out in your mind as having been like you know, say the most interesting, most fun, most challenging? Does anyone jump out?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it was most of the women entrepreneurs that I worked with who were the most interesting, because they were the most willing to take chances or try things that weren't just like, here's how you run a business. They're like, I'm running a business because I want to run a business the way I want to run it. I'm like, let's have some fun. So people like Danielle Laporte, I worked with her for probably about 12 or 13 years. I think I did about 12 or 13 different websites for her. So she was one of my like longest running, biggest client. And that was, yeah, she's just super, like, she's definitely very well known in the space that she's in, but she is ridiculously smart as well about all things business. So I feel like I learned for free as well. I feel, because I was just working with her, but I feel like I learned so much valuable stuff that I took and implemented in my own business. Just seeing the way that she ran her business and just seeing the way that she, some things were very important and it was more what would work for her and her audience than just this is the way the business is supposed to work. So I really took a lot from that. I feel like I learned a lot from her for sure.
Damn, finding a mentor and a client, that's pretty fascinating. Do you remember how you originally got this deal, landed her as a client?
Yeah, so I was working with a few other women entrepreneurs that had book deals at the time, and I started out with a few that weren't super well known, and then I connected with ones that were, and then obviously Danielle is a massive deal. And then I started to work with her, and then she introduced me to Chris and Marie, and then it just kind of went from there. But it was focus, man. Like, it was, like, focus. As soon as I found out, like, there's these people who are making money on the internet, who are doing some really cool things, who are doing a ton of writing. They're, like, the first bloggers who really approached blogging from, like, a business perspective. So not just I guess it's a business now, but like the Kot Keiser, the Derek Pozacks, or the people like that, or the, what's her name? I can't remember now. One of my favorite bloggers back in the day. But those people were blogging to share their stories. And then there was like another wave of bloggers who were like, I can make this content my business. And I was like, this is so incredibly interesting to me. I need to be part of this. And it's like, I knew how to web design. So I was just working with them and learning a lot from them. And then I guess that's kind of my job now too. So.
Well, that segues nicely into the first question that I've got up next for you. When did you first start blogging, really, you know, sharing your articles, putting some of the stuff you were learning into practice on your own side?
So on and off for 20 years. I started blogging when I started using the internet in the 90s, but that it kind of just fell to the wayside. Like I felt like I was too busy with work to do it. And then probably about 6 years ago, I figured I really like writing, really like the internet. I want to see if I can make this whole internet writing thing work. So I made a conscious and concerted effort to try to see if I could make money writing. So I was making really good money, not gonna lie, doing web design stuff. But I was like, if I want to try writing as a job, I want to separate my buckets of income and be like, okay, if I'm gonna be writing, I want to see if I can make a full-time income writing. So I kept it separate. And in the beginning, since I wasn't making any money writing, I approached things ridiculously cheap. Like you would no idea how much I bartered for in the beginning, and when I started writing, like for the first book that I wrote, I spent $0 on it. The photographer, and it was a cookbook, so the photographer got to eat all the food I made. That was a deal. The editor needed a website, so I traded her editing for the website. My friend was a chef at a 5-star restaurant in town, because my plates and cutlery are garbage. Like they're probably IKEA or something. Like they're not very pretty. They have fancy stuff. So I spent nothing on that book. And then when that book started to make money, then I started spending more money on my writing. But initially it was like, what can I do where I don't go into debt trying this out?
I love that. I think that's an approach that anyone starting today can take and learn from.
Yeah. I think it was fun as well, because I think creativity thrives on constraints. So I think like, what can I, and I feel like that was such a fun project, because I was like, what can I do like how smart can I be with what I do without spending any money? And I mean, I think it ended up being like such a cool product because of the way that I did it.
This is something that I actually want to dig into. This isn't the direction I plan on going, but this idea of creativity thrives under constraints is something that I also really resonate with. And I think, like, you know, looking back through the different projects I've done, courses, you know, books, things like that, like everything that's done really well has had some sort of deadline or a limit on how much I can spend on it. And that's something that cannot be ignored. And it's, you know, if you're just starting a blog today, which many of our people watching, listening here are doing, it's easy to just enter it without any sort of constraints, no deadline, no cap on how much they can spend, you know, nothing that's sort of forcing them to launch, forcing them to hit a certain goal. So, you know, how else has this manifested throughout your career, this idea of constraints?
Yeah, I mean, for pretty much everything, because my business is just me. Like, I don't have a staff. If I had a staff, I don't even know what they would do. Like, my business isn't that complicated. So it only really takes one person to do most of the things. Like, yes, I hire a lot of freelancers. I have a production person for videos and audio. I have a copy editor. I have a bunch of it, but like, they're freelancers and they do the work when I need them to do it. But as far as constraints go, I feel like even what I do with software now, because it's bootstrapped, because I don't have infinite budget. I've turned down a bunch of investment things because it's like, I don't know what I would do with that investment money. So I don't really need it. So even with like the software that I launch, there's constraints because it's not making money to start and I have to develop it. So I have to develop it as quickly as possible, launch as quickly as possible, try to get it down to the core, just the core features, just the core interactions, and figure out what can be sustainable. And I mean, I still think like that creates really interesting products. Like, I have a product that came out yesterday, so it's fresh in my mind, Fathom, which is an analytics platform that competes with Google Analytics, which sounds stupid to say because it really doesn't compete with Google Analytics, but it only does like two things. And Google Analytics does infinite things. Like, I don't know how to run every report. My life is the internet, and I don't know how to use 90% of Google Analytics. But it launched. We already have dozens of paying customers. It did well on Product Hunt and all of that. And it's like, it's viable, and it took two people a couple months to build this thing, and it works. And I think that, again, the constraints just make it kind of fun. Like, and we, the other guy is just as cheap as I am. So it's like, what can we do by spending the least? Like, we're running the product through one of our companies. So we don't want to spin up a separate company for it until it's making money. So like, everything we can do to do it as cheap as possible, it is good, because that's like, we want to see if it'll stand on its own two feet by itself without both of us pouring money into it. And I think that's a smart way to do it. Smart-ish way to do it.
I like that. No, I mean, essentially it's validation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So Paul, one of the things that I really admire most about you and your style of writing in particular, is that it so beautifully avoids bullshit and fluff. And, you know, something that I've seen quoted about you quite a lot is that it feels like, you know, you're actually on the other side of the screen reading an article to someone when they're going through the process and reading it, right? And so this is sort of, or the question I have for you is, has this been a natural kind of style for you that you've always just sort of had? Or is this something that you've kind of had to like curate and build and cultivate over the years?
Yeah, so my default answer for that is I'm not smart enough to be somebody else in my writing, but I think that's kind of a bullshit answer. So I think the real answer is that everybody has this innate ability to be themselves in their writing, in their performance, in whatever they do as a creative, but it's tough. Like, it's hard to do because it's scary to do. Because if you put on... let's say you put on airs to write like you want to sound more smart or more like a business person or more anything, it's safer, because if somebody rejects that, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting the person you're pretending to be who isn't you. Whereas if you are just you and somebody rejects that, they're rejecting specifically who you are, which sucks. Like, it 100% sucks. Like, everybody gets hate mail if they're out there and doing things in public and putting things out there in public. And if it's you putting things out there as you, being you, then it hurts sometimes. Like, I get such nasty emails from people. I'm like, do you realize, like, there's a human being on the other side? Like, it's not just you typing into a keyboard into the ether. So I think that it's not hard to do technically, because I think it's easy to just be yourself, but it's hard to do, I guess, emotionally, because you're putting you on the line in that scenario. And I mean, for me, I see that the benefits outweigh the drawbacks, because I can build an audience of people who I really like that like me for me. And they bet, like, even like when I survey them, and I think it was last year I did a survey, like, of the people who bought something from me, why did you click buy? There's so many things on the internet. Why did you buy a thing from me? And I thought, well, maybe it's because I'm like creating products that they specifically want, or I'm like hitting a nerve with topics that I cover in my courses or something like that. But overwhelmingly, the response was, I bought it because you made it. And that's like, that's huge for me. Like, that's my business. People buy different pieces of my knowledge, because like Amazon has something like 13 million books on Amazon. They're probably mostly business books. I haven't double checked the stat, but they're mostly business books. And so for me, writing a business book, it's not so much the topic of the business book that's going to make people want to buy it. It's the fact that I wrote it. And if they like what I have to say, then they're probably going to want to read it. That's why the same people who bought a vegan cookbook from me have bought an online business book from me and a book on creativity, and will hopefully buy my next book that comes out next year. So it's tough and it's difficult and it's hard and it's scary, but it's ultimately worth it.
Yeah. And there's a certain level of vulnerability kind of involved with this idea of like being unapologetically yourself too. So what would be your advice to people who are, you know, in the just getting started phase with the blog, or, you know, maybe they're building their writing muscle? How do you sort of advise them on finding their voice and like finding the courage to actually share in that way?
Yeah. So definitely watch all the Brené Brown videos and TED Talks for sure. But I think, I'm pretty sure it was Brené who said that there's a difference between being vulnerable and oversharing. And I think this is an important concept for new writers and new bloggers to understand, is that I may be 100% open and therefore vulnerable in my writing, but I'm only going to talk about certain topics, and I'm only going to talk about the topics that I'm comfortable being open and honest about. So for me, it's mostly my business and creativity. Like, I'm not going to write an article about my family life or anything like personal to me, because that's too much for me. Like, I don't want to overshare in that regard. So I think that the thinking about how scary it is to be yourself in your writing, I think that that's okay, because you can pick and choose what you're yourself in writing. Like, if you have a blog, it's probably covering a specific topic. So make sure it's a topic that you're okay talking about and being open about. Like, I talk about money all the time. So I write about business, and I write about my business. It's a one-person business and there's money involved. And so I had to be comfortable. I'm Canadian as well. Like, I don't like to talk about money stuff. but like, I had to get comfortable in doing it, because that's part of, like, if I'm going to be sharing about my business, then I'm going to be sharing every aspect of my business with people. And that's something that I had to come to terms with early on, because people were asking as well. Like, it's so funny. Like, people, one of the top Google searches for my name is Paul Jarvis net worth, which I think is ridiculous because it's such a stupid vanity metric. But like, I made a bit. So there's a video on my site. If you Google, because I'm like, I need to be at the top of the search results for Paul Jarvis net worth. Oh my God. So I made a video. Like, it's just an absolutely ridiculous video. It involves a 1989 Subaru or whatever. It's an Escort. It might be a Suzuki Escort, I think, something like that. But like, I made a ridiculous, because I'm like, people are curious about this. I'm going to share something. So there's a video of me being the least baller possible with a, it's a Suzuki Esteem. That's what it is.
There we go.
It wasn't even my car. Like, I borrowed this car for this video because, like, I don't have a 1989 Suzuki Esteem. Kind of wish I did. It was a fun car, but
that's amazing. But I mean, this like kind of goes full circle into being you and your style, right?
Yeah. Like, I'm a quirky fucking weird guy. Like, people expect that. Even in my welcome email for my newsletter, I talk about how I'm so excited that you signed up for my mailing list that I went out and I got your name tattooed on my arm. And I mean, like, I have a couple tattoos. Like, if you're listening to the audio, I'm showing my arms and I'm covered in tattoos. Like, it's on brand for me. And I find that if people don't, I think I even say shit in that email too. Because if people get really pissed off that I swear and it's like 30 emails in and now they feel angry that they liked me, but now they don't like me because I said a swear word, I'm like, I'm just going to get this all out of the way right in the beginning. So if you want to leave, you can do so right away. And we don't waste either of our time. So.
Yeah, that's smart. That's your brand. Establish it.
Yeah.
So shifting gears a little bit now, you've launched a few different online courses over the years, over 10,000 paying students, Creative Class that teaches the business of freelancing, Chimp Essentials that covers how to master your MailChimp game. Picking maybe one of these courses to focus on, why did you feel the need to create an entire course on one of these subjects? Like, what was the point?
Yeah, it was because I'm lazy. So the reason I make products is laziness.
Honest.
Yes, I'm very honest. So what I found, and this even goes back to like the cookbook that I wrote. Like, I was sick of answering the same email to different people. Like, oh, can I get some vegan red? Like, I'm thinking about being plant-based. Can I get some recipes? And I'm like, I've written this email like 100 times now. It's just like, I just make a book and I'm just going to give this book to people. So the same thing was courses. So I was writing a lot about freelancing for my newsletter and on various publications and stuff like that. And I would get the same questions about freelancing all the time from people in my inbox. And the good thing about writing and the good thing about writing with a specific cadence. So my newsletter is called the Sunday Dispatches. So I write an article every Sunday. The good thing about having a consistent writing practice and sharing that writing is that you get a lot of feedback. And so whenever I would write about freelancing, I would get way more questions than anything else. And whenever people would read my writing about freelancing, I would get emails with questions. And then eventually I was like, I probably got like 1,000 emails from people asking about the like the business of freelancing. So maybe I'll just make a course. And then same with Chimp Essentials. Like, I got to a point where I couldn't take on any more clients doing like email marketing consulting and MailChimp setup. So I was like, what if I just teach everybody how to do this instead? Because then I can record all the lessons once or every time MailChimp changes their interface, which is a lot. So I actually have to record the lessons a lot because I have to redo them because I'm a perfectionist in that regard. So yeah, it was mostly like I make products in the laziest way. I make products that people hound me to make. Like, that's really how it works for a lot of things. And yeah, I mean, the newest ones, I make products that gain quick and easy traction at this point, where if I can share a screenshot and maybe a landing page and it gets a lot of traction, then I'm like, okay, I probably want to make this now. But in the beginning, my audience wasn't big enough to kind of judge that. So I had to do it based on like the, how many emails have I received about this specific topic that people really want to know? And now I'm going to make this thing.
Can you walk us, just even if it's high level, through kind of your game plan of what happens once you decide, okay, I'm going to make a course on this subject because people are asking me to, what happens next? You immediately, you know, take this approach of like throwing up a landing page, see who like joins the waiting list or something else?
For products, like software products, yes. For courses, I tend to get on the phone first with people because what I found, like, I can send an email to my mailing list that's like a survey and I'll get a couple thousand responses. And that's really good for like general, like aggregate data. But I find that that kind of doesn't like, it's hard for people to honestly write their like pains and frustrations or hangups with a topic in a survey. Like, it just feels so impersonal. So what I tend to do is just get on the phone and just have some informal conversations with people who would, so the type of people who I would be specifically trying to target for the thing I'm making, I would just want to talk to them about like what they're working on, what they're struggling with, where they're at, why something isn't working. And I tend to, it's almost like an, it sounds stupid, but like most people when they're struggling with something are kind of like an onion, where they think they have a problem, they think the problem that they have is a specific problem, but it's typically a problem that's like three layers back. Like, for example, a good way to describe this is somebody, when I was a web designer, somebody would come to me and say, hey, Paul, I need a website that looks good. So I want to hire you because you make good looking websites. And I do. But what they would really mean is they wanted more business or more or like a bigger audience or something else. So the end result was they wanted something that looked good. But the reason they wanted something that looked good would be like two or three layers back. It's the same with like talking to people, like getting a sense of how to make a course. They might say like, I need more clients for my freelancing business. And it might not be that. It might be that they're getting a lot of people in the door, but they just don't know how to close a deal. Like if I got on the phone with somebody when I was freelancing, I would like 9 times out of 10, probably higher percentage than that, be able to close the deal on the phone because I knew what, and like I'm a quirky, weird guy. Like I'm not a sales guy, but I would know the things that I would need to bring up and how to listen and how to like repeat things back. So I would know that if somebody's saying like, I can't get clients and I dug into it a bit further, I would see like, okay, you need to really learn how to close a deal. Or you need to learn how to update your portfolio, or you need to know how to position your expertise, even though you don't want to sound like you're bragging. Like there would always be a few layers back. So talking on the phone with somebody would always give me really, really good information to really tap into like, what do you really, really need? When you say this, you probably mean this, but don't even know it. And so talking on the phone, it's not scalable and I don't care. And it's just, it gives you so much more information in terms of like building something in the future. That's step one.
So what happens next then? So you've got, you know, some of this qualitative feedback too, right? So you've got basically your audience is helping you to create an outline for your course through phone calls, through email feedback, through surveys. So do you immediately sort of jump into content creation after that?
Yes, but I'll tend to take what I've learned from the phone and take kind of, so in listening on the phone, I'm listening to both what they're saying, what they're not saying, but I'm also listening to how they're describing things and I'm making notes of that because when people are trying to sell something like a course, they're making a course because they're an expert in a subject. The way experts talk about a topic is very different than the way somebody who's not an expert but wants to talk about a subject. So from those calls, I also basically write my sales page from the information that the people have given me on the phone. And that tends to be step one is like, I have an idea for a thing. I've done a survey. I've talked to people on the phone. How would I sell this thing? And this is like, I think I stole this from Amazon. I think Amazon, their engineering department has to write the sales page before they start building a new product. I'm like, that's a good idea. It's good enough for Bezos. It's good enough for me. So I try to write the sales page. I don't even share that with anybody. I just like for my own, like, if I can do this, like, does this sound good? Does this sound like something I can genuinely sell from like my own unique, weird voice? Does this sound like something compelling enough for somebody to buy? And so I just try, and I think that also helps me figure out like what I need to touch on and how I need to kind of position the way that I teach it is by writing the sales page. And a lot of times that really gives me a good sense of like, okay, if these are the pains that people are going through that will make them want to buy it, where it'll actually help them, this is the order that I could see it going through. Okay, now I have like the lesson plan. And then from there, it's like writing a book and writing a course are pretty much the same thing, except for the very last step. So because I'm a writer, I'll next write out like the chapter outline, the lesson outline, and then write the rough draft, like all of the points I want to cover in each chapter or each lesson, and then write out how the lesson or the chapter is going to, like, it's the exact same for me because I've done both a bunch of times. And so I get that all like as good as possible. Then I'll move into like the video, the multimedia, the audio and all of that. But like every course starts out basically like a book for me.
I love that. It's a ton of work though.
Yeah, it kind of is. See, I'm like, I've done this for years now and it's still a ton. Like I just made a course for the book that's coming out and I'm like, yeah, this still takes a long time. Like this is still months of work, even though I spent years working on the book.
Speaking of the book, I wanted to ask you, you know, the title is called Company of One. It breaks down some of your, what you could say, counterintuitive approaches to building a business that's designed to stay small and kind of deliberately avoid growth, scaling, startups. So why did this book in particular have to escape your head and make its way onto the pages?
Because I've lived this for 20 years, Ryan. Like, this has been the way, so unconsciously at first and then realization and then consciously was that I didn't want to grow a big business. Like I like sitting in my house and working on my own. Like this, like I am so well suited to be a writer or a blogger or a content creator on the internet because I like long periods of focus time alone making things. And so the book really came about, I was talking to some people and they're like, you know, the way you approach business is the opposite of everybody else, like that gets press, right? And I'm like, yeah, I guess, but like, I don't know. It just seems like some weird quirky thing that I personally do. But then I wrote an article about it and I shared it with my mailing list and on my website about how I don't want to grow a business. And then I got like inundated with people being like, I thought I was the only one who was like this. And I thought I was like, holy shit. There's like a, it's like the worst pun ever, but there's like a growing movement of people who don't want to grow their business. And then I talked to an agent who I found through my mailing list. And the good thing about having a mailing list that you write with and connect with all the time is that sometimes if you ask them for things, they'll come through. Like I wrote 2 years ago in January that I wanted to write this book, Company of One, and does anybody know an agent? Because I don't know any. And I got like a dozen contacts and I ended up working with an agent from one of those contacts. And so, yeah, that was and then it escaped my brain. And the book is really just talking about other people building businesses that are better, not necessarily bigger. And yeah, it's more like research stories, like my brand of like weird non sequitur instances and examples. But yeah.
I love this. If there's any theme to kind of like pull a thread through all of this, it's like every product, every book, every course is born out of laziness because you're asked about it so much.
Yes, exactly. that's exactly my MO.
All right, Paul, well, this is the last question I have for you. What would you say has been the best investment you've ever made in the context of growing your business? And this could be in the form of time, money, tools, products, services, education, or otherwise.
Probably be a tie between us. That's such a me answer. It would be a tie between paying for my MailChimp account, which is my biggest expense, my biggest business expense every month in terms of software, and working at staying healthy through like exercise, going to the gym, yoga, biking, hiking, all of that. I don't know. It's either mailing list software or doing lots of yoga. One of the two. I don't know. They're probably tied. But I think that one, most of my revenue comes from a mailing list. So I'd be dumb if I ignored that fact. So I always gladly invest in, like, I pay that, like, I'm happy when I pay that bill and I'm super cheap. So it was really weird for me to be like that. And then the other thing is that my business relies a lot on my like brain and thinking and creativity. and my brain lives in my body. And if my body isn't taken care of, then like, it's so funny. Like I started a food journal probably like 7 or 8 years ago to see how well I could produce creative work after eating certain types of foods. And it was huge for me in terms of like, oh, I can be this much more creative if I don't eat this, this, and this. It's like, why am I eating these things? I don't care how delicious they are. So, I mean, taking care of yourself and, yeah, and using a mailing list, definitely the tide for number one for me.
Two drastically different things, but very important. I agree.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, Paul, thank you for joining us. Can you tell everyone watching, listening, where they can go to learn more about you and all of the different projects you're up to?
Sure. If you Google Paul Jarvis or just go to pjrbs.com, which is impossible to remember. So I just say Google Paul Jarvis. My mailing list is the best place to keep track of what I do. It's also where I share all of my writing. I don't post all of it on my, if I remember, I post it to my blog. I don't always remember to do that, but it always goes to my mailing list every single Sunday, no exceptions. So the Sunday Dispatches is literally the best and really the only place to find out what I'm thinking and what I'm working on.
Beautiful. All right. Well, Paul, thank you again.
Yeah, thanks, buddy.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.